This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. The 70s, that was a long, strange trip, both literally and figuratively. And Vermont was knee-deep in it. Hundreds of thousands of college-educated young Americans from middle-class suburban neighborhoods headed back to the land around the country, and we got our share of them here. Some formed communes, others just got back to the land on their own farms. But it had a massive influence on the culture of Vermont. The Vermont Historical Society has been working for a couple of years on a project called Freaks, Radicals, and Hippies, Counterculture in 1970s Vermont. And a new book is out called We Are As Gods, Back to the Land in the 1970s on the Quest for a New America that relates the stories of some Vermont communes. So joining us today is Kate Dalos, author of that book, and Jackie Calder and Amanda Gustin from the Vermont Historical Society. Welcome to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, so what happened, Amanda, in Vermont in the early 70s that brought that different-looking crowd into the state?
So this was happening nationally, and Vermont became a center sort of for the Northeast. We're seeing people coming from all of the New England states, from New York, from New Jersey, to Vermont. The why Vermont question is one that sort of haunted us throughout this project. And I'm not sure it's one we have a perfect answer for yet, but it seems to have been a combination of a lot of things. Some people tell us there was just something in the air, something about Vermont that made it the place to go. And certainly as that began to happen, it was like a rock rolling downhill. More and more things happened and more people came.
Jackie, what did they find here? What was Vermont like, you know, pre this wave of hippies coming to Vermont?
Well, one of the things they're finding and what they're looking for is inexpensive land. So they're moving into these rural communities where there'd been a decline in farming. And some farm families are very happy to sell their older homes or their rundown farms, and they scoop them up. But one of the things that we realized when we started doing this project is the poverty that was here in Vermont. Vermont wasn't doing very well. A lot of rural poverty and urban poverty. And that really came to the attention of a lot of these people after a while.
Wow. Kate, this was not just a Vermont thing, like Amanda said. So what was going on around the country, and where else were people seeing great influxes of these counterculture individuals?
One of the earliest areas that city people flooded into rural places was in the American Southwest. So in Colorado, New Mexico, in the Taos area, which we sort of has that counterculture reputation still today. Yeah. Obviously, Northern California. So these are people coming out of San Francisco in the way that people coming out of New York and Boston headed up to Vermont and also Maine. People leaving San Francisco headed up the coast or to the Southwest.
So we're headed back to the land today, back to the garden, back to the 70s on Vermont Edition. We want to hear from you. We want you to hop in the VW bus with us. You can share your stories from the 70s Vermont or ask a question about what it was like. Call 1-800-639-2211, 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or on our Vermont Edition Facebook page. Kate, one thing, it wasn't particularly organized, except in a few instances. I mean, in your book, you say something like, and Amanda kind of said it too, people just picked up this idea in the air. So how is it happening?
You know, that was one of the questions I had that made me want to do enough research that I could answer that question myself, because my parents were part of this movement. Mm-hmm. And the way they always described their experience was, you know, it was just it was very personal, it was individual. We just had this idea. We wanted, you know, to learn to build our own houses. We wanted to grow our own food. And as I got older, I kept thinking, well, wow, you guys had the same idea the same year as, you know, possibly as many as a million other people all around the country during this time period. That can't just have been totally individual. It must have been in the culture somewhere. And so I, you know, what I could find, again, it's always tricky trying to pinpoint something like this, but you start to see references to the idea of land and as land as a place of solving problems in the culture, the idea that if you could go back and get sort of like a pure, undeveloped piece of land, you could start a society that would solve the problems of the current society. And you start to see that happening in 1967, pretty much right around the time of the Summer of Love. And then, you know, the Summer of Love in San Francisco, is remembered in history as having been very utopian and wonderful, but it was actually pretty intense. It was crowded. There was a lot of drug problems. There were a lot of runaways. And so the older counterculture people who had been in the Haight-Ashbury previous to that really looked at the situation and thought, no, this isn't working for us. We need to find something new. And for them, rural places became an opportunity to kind of keep rebelling, keep solving the problems of the societal problems that they were interested in solving, but where the city wasn't working for them anymore. So yeah. Right around 1967, you start to see it happen in underground press and places like that.
Amanda, this idea of getting back to the land actually had some historical precursors. Where did this new wave draw their inspiration and guidance from?
Sure. So this is, as you say, not a totally unique idea in American history. I mean, we see communes in the 19th century as well, based on various versions of a utopian ideal. But I think the nearest precursor has a Vermont connection. A lot of people during this time cited Helen and Scott Nearing's book, Living the Good Life, as a major influence on them. And Helen Scott Nearing had been in Vermont maybe about 40 years previously and had lived out their own version of this back-to-the-land philosophy here in Vermont and had written their book about it. So this does have some historical precedent in the 20s and 30s. And there is a little bit of a national movement in the 20s and 30s as well to go back to the land.
Yeah, it did seem like people would pick up the book by the Nearings and all of a sudden, boom, they got this idea, I've got to get back to the land, right?
They make it sound really appealing in some ways and really not appealing in other ways if you're not a person who's not already leaning that way. Some of it sounds like not a ton of fun. But if you are, as Kate says, if you are looking back to try and wipe the slate clean and start over from the ground up and build something for your ideals, it does provide some good ideas.
Kate, one of the things I absolutely loved reading in your book was that Pearl S. Buck, who lived in Vermont for a time, actually told the Nearings they need to write about their life, and that's how the book got written.
Yeah, you know, the history of Living the Good Life, and as you say, it was absolutely a crucial inspiration for people, not just in Vermont, but all over the country. And I learned a lot, actually, in the research of this book about the book. I thought it was super interesting that Pearl S. Buck, whose husband was the editor, and that's how they happened to be visiting together, and she looked around for a previous book of Scott Nearing's, and she went to visit them in Jamaica, Vermont, and looked around and thought, wow, you guys should write a book about this. This is amazing what you're doing. So that was 1955 that they wrote the original draft of Living the Good Life, and basically that particular edition didn't sell a ton of copies, and it wasn't until 1970 that that Schocken Books reissued Living the Good Life with a foreword, which I was surprised to read because I had often heard of Living the Good Life as having kicked off the Back to the Land movement of the 1970s. And in fact, the edition that I read, which was, you know, the one that was issued in 1970, has a foreword by Paul Goodman saying, you know, who should read this is the kids today who are already going back to the land. They can learn a lot from the Nearings. And that was really interesting to me that it was actually reissued in response to a Back to the Land movement that was already underway.
That's pretty great. Listeners, you can join the conversation today about the 70s, what happened in Vermont, the communes. Call 1-800-639-2211, 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Mary Ann, who's calling from Bradford. Mary Ann, hello there.
Oh, hi. I think my point's already been brought up because you were talking about how the Back to the Land movement might have began, and the book by the Nearings is what I wanted to mention, that I think that had an influence on a lot of folks that came to Vermont since they had, you know, been back to the land in Vermont.
Well, Mary Ann, you read it. How did it influence you?
Well, I'm from New Jersey, and now I live in Vermont, so it took me a lot of years to get here, but, you know, I think, and I was a little behind the curve. I was, more of a child of the late 70s and early 80s, but it was still going around, the book, and I think a lot of people still had that kind of mindset, and I guess influenced me to always sort of seek a more rural existence or more closer to nature existence.
Yep. Well, thanks for calling, Mary Ann. Kate, another book or actually catalog that that had an influence on that time was the Whole Earth Catalog. Explain to people what that was and how the Back to the Landers, the hippies, were using it.
Oh, the Whole Earth Catalog is amazing. And probably there's one in either, if not your neighbor's basement, you can probably find one. They're floating around. They're big, oversized, on kind of rough paper. The covers are that beautiful, iconic black background with, in the original one, a picture of the Earth as seen from space right in the middle. And the tagline is access to tools. And so this was an invention really of Stuart Brand, who, you know, was sort of already by the mid-60s kind of a leading figure in the counterculture. And he had this insight while he was in an airplane flying back from his father's funeral. And he'd already been thinking about the idea of the Earth as seen from space. And he knew, you know, the idea of Whole Earth was from a previous project of his in which he was asking why hasn't NASA released photographs of the Earth as seen from space. And it was kind of this idea that we should all have access to that image to see this Mother Earth of ours. And you know, people, historians now are giving it credit for sort of helping along a burgeoning like environmental consciousness. Mm-hmm. But the invention he had was he this is in 1967. He had all these friends, as I was saying earlier, that were moving from California to the at that point the Southwest, and basically just starting from scratch with this idea of in the way that they would have put it, primitive living, trying to live as simply as possible, grow their own food. And they didn't really know what they were doing, and they didn't always have even simple tools that they needed. So he thought, wow, really, if they want to do this, what they need is something like the L.L. Bean catalog where they can just get everything. And so that line of thinking led him to, let's put together a catalog that is going to show people where they can get their hands on everything they might need for whatever it is that they're doing right now so that they have, you know, as the tagline says, access to tools. And it was incredibly influential there. It's just an amazing document to look at it. The pages are just crammed together with all kinds of stuff. So you'll have like a review of the Neerings book, which is one of the places that people found it actually initially, is that the Whole Earth Catalog gave it, you know, pride of place. And you'll find that next to where to send away for like a windmill. And, you know, here's a book on tantric sex or like whatever the handbooks were that the editors of the Whole Earth Catalog thought were necessary.
I was a young teenager when Dennis Lyne down the street got a copy of it. And we were totally fascinated by it, not knowing exactly what it was all about, but just absolutely loved it. Jackie Calder, if I was tooling around Vermont in the early 70s, where would I have seen these pockets of hippies?
Oh, you would have really had to go up into the hills.
Mm-hmm.
They were in particular in Guilford, up near Packer Corners and Johnson Pasture. There were several communes up there, very different communes. Packer Corners, a group of friends who had worked with Liberation News, very politically connected, very radical. Johnson's Pasture, much more that you think about as Back to the Land people. Mm-hmm. Right next to them were Brotherhood of the Spirit, who would come up to visit from very much a sort of centralized control spiritual community. There was a lesbian community up in that area. Not very far from there was Newsreel, Red Clover, very radical group of people who had a big influence on Vermont in terms of organizing communes. Then up in the Northeast Kingdom, Frog Run Farm, which is very much a back-to-the-land farming commune. Madbrook in East Charlton, very much a writers and artists who had got together in Hartford and came up starting to look for land, and then Franklin in Franklin, Vermont, mm-hmm. Coming from California looking for a place to create back to the land, but also very politically aware group of people.
And I know in Kate's book, Myrtle Hill was in the Glover area. There was also one up in Norton, right on the border of Canada. Let's go back to the phones and talk to Sylvia, who's calling from Barton. Sylvia, thanks for joining us today.
Hi. Yes. Thank you. I'm glad you could take my call.
Go ahead.
Oh, well, I'm calling to really commend Jackie Calder's work and the Vermont Historical Society, and also Kate's book. I spent decades wishing that we could have some serious treatment of what we were trying to do in those days I was up here at Mullen Hill, Myrtle Hill, and also in the Burlington Red Clover, Mount Siloam. And I just thought that it was so sad that Hollywood had just caricatured those efforts, and we lost that essential goodness of what a generation really tried to do, as though it were the most important thing that could happen. And now I think with Kate's book and this attention, we're at least in Vermont, and I hope Kate continues to contribute. You know, there's such as Utopian Studies and et cetera, that there's serious attention to a really needed recommitment to saving the whole earth.
And Sylvia, since you were there, what was it like living in the commune at Myrtle Hill at the time?
Well, and I did live with others, and they were, as Jackie said, so each of them was a different emphasis and different. And shall we call it Myrtle Hill? It wasn't necessarily my favorite, but it was committed to trying to save a stewardship of land for the future, even with all our inadequacies. And it was hard. It was hard work. When I hear people just making fun of it, I just wish they had ever worked so hard or suffered as much discomfort and hardship and actual deprivation as we were willing to go through to try to make it work.
Well, Sylvia, thank you so much for sharing your remembrances of that time. That was fabulous. Amanda, did you talk to others who had, during this project over 2 years, who had lived on communes around the state?
Oh, absolutely. So I'm glad that Sylvia brought up that we're just at the very beginning of a serious treatment of this time period, because one of our main goals for this project, we've only just touched the surface in our initial conclusions and tried to learn a few things, but one of our real goals for this project was to create a collection that will live at the Vermont Historical Society and be part of our collections that will be the basis for continued study. So as part of this longer project, which was funded by a grant, we have done oral histories. We had committed to doing 50. We're coming up on 70 now. We did a statewide survey in which we just said, please just tell us the people, the places, the books that you read, the ideas that you remember, the organizations that you were part of. And we got closing out about 750 responses to that. And then hundreds more people emailed us individually and said, I have too many memories to fit into the little boxes on your survey.
Oh, wow.
So we've collected those. We held forums around the state where we had open mic nights and just asked people to share their stories and tell us what we don't know yet. So we have all of those memories recorded. And we also have been collecting objects, papers, posters, books, the Whole Earth Catalog. We have copies of that in our collection now.
Well, to that NLPNT post-it, I've heard the Whole Earth catalogs described as the internet before the internet. Another book that was a must-have was John Muir's How to Keep Your Volkswagen Alive, a manual of step-by-step procedures for the complete idiot. So there's another sharing. We are talking about Vermont in the 70s, what it was like to live in a commune, how all those long-haired hippie freaks were accepted or weren't once they got here to Vermont. And coming up, we'll look at some of the long-lasting effects of that hippie invasion. Our guests are Kate Dalos, author of We Are As Gods, and Amanda Gustin and Jackie Calder of the Vermont Historical Society. If you were there in 1970 as a communard or an observer, call 1-800-639-2211, 1-800-639-2211, or you can email us at vermontedition@vpr.net. I'm Rick Singeri, and this is Vermont Edition. As if by some high-pitched dog whistle that only certain people could hear, in the late 60s and early 70s, tons of young people had to get out, man. They headed out of the cities and into the countryside to start new lives, many times with a large group of others on a commune. Vermont was part of it. The state saw a 15% increase in population during the 70s, the biggest jump since back in the 1700s. We're talking with Kate Dalos, who is the author of We Are As Gods, and also from the Vermont Historical Society, curator Jackie Calder, and public program coordinator Amanda Gustin. So come on, get out the love beads and the dashiki, travel back with us to the 70s. What do you remember, maybe hazily, about that time in Vermont? Did you live in a commune? What was life like back then? You can share by calling 1-800-639-2211 or by posting on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Now, Kate, just before the break, we had the comment about the Whole Earth Catalog being described as the Internet before the Internet. Is that how you saw it? And didn't it kind of lead, in a way, to the Internet?
Yeah, that was one of the things that I was most interested and surprised to find in my research, is that there's, you know, again, as scholars are turning their attention to this time period in kind of a new way, there's pretty much consensus leading that the Whole Earth Catalog and then Stuart Brand himself literally turned his attention to computers and computer networks after the Whole Earth Catalog. That was his next project. And one of the earliest, most influential chat rooms was called Whole Earth Electronic Link, or WELL. And it's given a lot of credit for the culture of the Internet as we experience it today, this idea that what the Internet should be, what it should be used for, is that users should pool their resources, pool their information, you know, pool skills, like all of those. The fact that YouTube is used for so many do-it-yourself videos, the fact that there's, you know, reviews and comment boards and all of that kind of idea that the Internet should be people getting together and contributing to making a body of knowledge that's useful to other people. That line of thinking really can actually be traced right back to the Whole Earth Catalog. It's not just a metaphor.
So here in Vermont, Jackie, this movement gave rise to a lot of other things that we're seeing today. So start us off by telling us, you know, some of the things that we can kind of trace back to that time in Vermont history.
Certainly the food movement. The organic food movement of the time. There definitely was a suspicion of the corporate entity that controlled the food distribution system in the country, and people felt we needed to get back to a direct link to farmers. So you have a lot of people working on creating co-ops around the state. And so you have the Plainfield Co-op starting and the Burlington Co-op starting. Also, at the same time, you have people who are the organic farmers organizing under NOFA and getting a distribution network set up so that farmers could actually grow specific crops and make money on them and get that good food out to the people. That was a very much based in a political movement.
I was amazed reading in Kate's book about Entropy Acres, who had this agreement with Shaw Markets back in 1971 to sell all those organic carrots for 16 cents a pound when the regular carrots were going for $8. They didn't make a whole lot of money. It was a backbreaking work, but organics go back that far. Amanda, other things that we see today that go back to this movement?
Sure. I think one of the important things to remember is that we tend to think of back to the land and the people who went back to the land, but they also had a whole host of other causes, of other issues for which they were activists or protesting against. Social justice was huge, under which you can include a lot of things like improving access to health care. As Jackie mentioned, Vermont was a deeply poor state and a rural state, so a lot of people who came up were familiar with how to use government programs to increase access to health care, to dental care, to reform education and increase educational opportunities from kindergarten right on up through college and university experiments. A lot of political work and a lot of work in advancing the rights of previously sort of overlooked communities. Gay rights and women's rights were both made huge strides forward during this time and continued to move on forward. And just a lot of people who had the education and the drive to get involved in their community and to sort of make a lot of those small changes that over time build up and result in different systems and different ways of living.
And Kate, I know it's not a big part of the story, but even Bernie Sanders made an appearance at a commune.
Yeah, it's had heard through sort of the counterculture grapevine. He wasn't himself in a commune, but he knew many people who were, and he was friends with the sort of Back to the Land network at the time. And he had heard through the grapevine that Lorraine of Myrtle Hill had her first daughter conventionally in a hospital and her second daughter at home at the commune, which was sort of in the middle of nowhere in the Northeast Kingdom. And he was interested in writing an article comparing the experience of hospital birth to home birth. And he came to Myrtle Hill to talk to her. And what's kind of funny is that I had been talking to Lorraine for years, and she'd been saying, oh, you know, Bernie came and he asked me about this article, and I have it here somewhere, and she just couldn't quite put her hands on it. And then when, you know, Bernie's star started to rise these last couple of years, he Mother Jones did a whole profile of him, and one of the reporters actually found this article about Lorraine and put it online. And so there are details in my book from that scene of Lorraine's birth of her daughter at Myrtle Hill that my source was an article written by Bernie Sanders in 1971. It was pretty amazing. It's a great article. It's still really relevant, which is sort of, you know, in some ways kind of sad.
That is so great. Okay, we have got to get to some of the calls. Let's start with Elizabeth in Jericho. Elizabeth, thank you so much for calling Vermont Edition.
Hi. I have not read these books, but I think I'd like to reframe the discussion. It's being presented that the Back to the Landers somehow changed Vermont, and I saw it differently. My husband went to Dartmouth. We were married in 1966, and he was in medical school, and we wanted to live in northern New England. And he wanted a place where he could train to be a doctor and be a doctor, and yet we would have a very different lifestyle from the one in which we grew up in suburban New York. So we bought land from a farmer by the name of Harley Tobin, who, right after we bought the land, he said, "And where are you folks staying tonight?" And we said, "Well, we don't know. We'll probably go back to a motel." He said, "Oh, no. Stay here with us and have dinner with us." The openness was just astonishing to me. And then when we left Harley's, and on the way back to Burlington to get on the interstate to go to Boston, which was not entirely built at that. I mean, not Boston, but the interstate wasn't built entirely at that time. We stopped at Powell's place in Essex Center, and we told the soda jerk, who happened to be Marty Powell, who happened to be a retired school principal and then became a representative. We said to Harley, or my husband did, he said, we're married, and we just bought land from a Harley Tobin, and we want to adopt 13 children, all of different colors. What do you think of that?" And Marty said, "Well, if you can handle 13 children, why should it be a problem for me?"
Well, Elizabeth, make an absolutely great point, and I want to put this to Jackie Calder. So we are kind of looking at it as people who wanted to go back to land coming to Vermont. But what they found in Vermont were people who were pretty much already or still back to the land. Right? So who was influencing whom?
Well, your call is perfectly correct in that connection between people who were here, especially farmers whose kids left. They weren't going to run the farm anymore. And then these people coming in to look at how to farm the way the previous generation did, say, with using animals more or using old farm equipment, not using fertilizer. Chemical fertilizer. And so what we find is at first people will move in who look different, who are from away. So there's a little initial suspicion. But then very quickly they start to connect. There's a lot of neighborliness. People, you know, you can't really live in a rural area and survive, especially in the wintertime.
Yeah.
And so we find that very quickly these connections and wonderful friendships are made.
Yeah, Kate, there was a symbiosis, wasn't there, that existed between these long-haired hippie freaks and these very conservative farmers once the hippies got here, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, just as Jackie just said and just as the caller mentioned, you know, that's a theme. You can't talk to Back to the Landers or without hearing their tremendous gratitude for their neighbors in almost every case. There's a couple, you know, obviously there were tensions here and there, but not only were they excited, the young people coming in from elsewhere were excited to learn skills that the older people had and were eager to pass on to young people when their own children had to leave in many cases to find more economic opportunities elsewhere. But they were sort of tickled, actually, by seeing young people come in and show this interest in older technologies that they had, known and moved on from in their own past, and sort of, you know, helping them troubleshoot how to use horse-drawn equipment, or, you know, sort of scratching their heads like, okay, I heard a couple people say, well, I don't know, I didn't want to use an outhouse. I was pretty glad that I was done with that portion of my life where I had to use an outhouse. But if they wanted to do it, I don't know, it's their business. And so in some cases, they were kind of amused. But the Back to the Landers themselves, over and over again, you hear people say, man, if my neighbor hadn't come along and told me, well, you probably shouldn't, you know, you probably should get some dry wood because you're going to be cold all winter if you try to burn greenwood. That was a theme that you hear a lot in Vermont. You hear it a little bit in other parts of the country, but not anything like the extent of that reciprocity that happened here.
All right. Let's talk to Tamsin. He's calling from Burlington. Tamsin, how are you? This is Vermont Edition. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Tamsin Goldfield. I'm a female. Thank you.
Sorry.
I'm so glad to be able to contribute to this. I love NPR and I love your show. I just wanted to say that I was in Kirby, Vermont from 70 to 75 near Lindenville, and we were able to buy 10.5 acres for $7,500. We had a maple forest in back, and then high pines. We had an opening field in front of our sort of basic cabin. A builder had put together sort of the shell of what we were able to buy. And the point being is that my husband and I were both from Connecticut, and we had lived in southern Vermont in a cabin in the Green Mountain National Forest, and we had decided we really wanted to start our own place. So the book that we found was Finding and Buying Your Place in the Country. And we spent the entire summer camping throughout Vermont, and we ended up in Kirby. And it was a wonderful experience. And in terms of the communes, we were friends with people from Lost Nation. I don't know if either of the authors know of that particular location, but we were friends with people in Lost Nation, but we were just not comfortable with the amount of drugs and the amount of unsanitary conditions. So we sort of kept to ourselves, but we did homestead and lived off the land for those 5 years.
Wow. Hey, Tamsin, thank you so much for remembering that for us. Kate, let's not sugarcoat it. There was a lot of free love and nudity and, as Tamsin mentioned, drug use going on at these communes, correct?
Well, some of them, and then other ones, not at all. I mean, I think it's one of the things that was interesting to me in finding out, doing research about communes all over the country, is they were really, really distinct from one another, and they really did have separate personalities. And so some, as Jackie and Amanda mentioned earlier, were very politically committed, very politically active, and really made that their focus. And so the communal living for them was a way of supporting a group of people in this action that they may not have been getting paid enough to be living, on their own. In other places, yeah, absolutely. That was part of the ethic of the place. I have to say that in Vermont and in really, really rural places, there probably wasn't as much drug use going on as possible because they just didn't have access to getting it. And so they were relying on other people coming in and bringing it with them. And then somebody would show up and then there would be a party and then that was it especially with drugs that were harder to get a hold of. So I actually was surprised that the drug use was kind of less than I would have thought, not necessarily by choice, actually.
We are stuck in the 70s today with Jackie Calder and Amanda Gustin of the Vermont Historical Society and author Kate Dalos. There's still time to share your memories of a crazy time in Vermont's history. You can call 1-800-639-2211, or you can send an email to vermontedition@vpr.net. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. The Vermont Historical Society has been working for a couple of years on a project called Freaks, Radicals, and Hippies, Counterculture in 1970s Vermont. And author Kate Dalos has a new book called We Are As Gods, Back to the Land in the 1970s on the Quest for a New America, that relates to the stories of some Vermont communes. That's what we're talking about today. And we are asking you for your stories. We've got a ton of them and questions. Chris writes, your guests today have not mentioned the influence of the Vietnam War. As I remember it, it was a primary driving force behind the movement. So, Amanda, how about that? How big was the Vietnam War to sending all these young people out away from the cities and going back to the land?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely key. I think your commenter is absolutely correct. And that's something we hear over and over and over again from all the people who have offered their memories or shared things with us, that it was just this omnipresent backgrounding of everything that was going on. We hear from people who founded communes close to the Canadian border because that was an easy way to get away. We hear from communes who were very, very involved in helping people declare conscientious objector status. A number of people we interviewed were COs themselves. And we hear from communes who participated in networks helping draft resistors get to Canada as well, or who would drive down to Washington, D.C. altogether to protest the war or various things. And I think it's really difficult, although perhaps not as it's a little easier more recently, to understand how deeply present that war and the threat of being drafted was in the lives of everyone.
Dennis in Middlesex writes, I hope you're going to speak about how this was mostly an upper class and upper middle class driven social movement. I can't think of one Vermont commune started by people from the inner city. Kate, you mentioned this quite often in your book, the makeup of the people who did come here to Vermont.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I know that Jackie and Amanda found the same kind of demographics in Vermont that I found nationwide, which is overwhelmingly white and people from middle class or at least financial, you know, or affluent or comfortable backgrounds, very educated. I think more educated in Jackie and Amanda found an extremely high level of education for Vermonters who went back to the land, and nationwide. That was certainly people with access to college, whether or not they actually had finished their degrees before they went back to the land. And so when I started to think about this and make sense of it, one of the key things that made sense to me was, one of the characteristics of this back to the land movement was this group of people really deciding that where we are is not working. Society is not working for us, even though, you know, the whole society basically had sort of conspired to, make them be at sort of the height of privilege. They had access to the best jobs. They were in a position to kind of inherit their parents' world, and they didn't want it in the case of these young people. And so to me, that was a really interesting there's a great quote by a sociologist who says, never before have so many who had so much been so disinherited with their inheritance. And so disenchanted with their inheritance. And to me, that was really interesting. A group of people who had this position of tremendous privilege and then chose to turn away from it and to see life in a rural area starting over, in their view, from scratch, choosing anachronism and, you know, technologies from a previous time, looking for skill sets that they didn't have in a professional world of growing and building and things like that, that it was that combination of feeling like they had a life that they could choose, they had all of the choices in the world to make, and that this is what they chose to do with it. But really, almost everybody I talked to, even, you know, maybe not at first, maybe it wasn't even clear to them at the time, but they also felt that they were safe enough, secure enough in society that they could take this huge risk and step away from what would have been a very set career path for them and take this big risk that they didn't really know and still be okay and that their kids would be okay. And to by and large, that's absolutely true. Even people who made very radical choices chose very, very austere living conditions that would have looked in many ways like rural poverty. I've been racking my brain to find any of them whose children didn't go right back into the middle class exactly in the same position in society that their parents had stepped away from.
Wow.
Making lots of interesting choices, holding on to environmentalism in a lot of cases and holding on to those progressive politics, but not actually continuing a life of the kind of rural poverty that their parents had, you know, had chosen for themselves.
Yep. Let's go back to the phones. Jack is calling from Middlebury. Jack, thank you so much for calling Vermont Edition.
Yeah, hi. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah. Thanks for taking my call. So I was a young doctor in Vermont in the early 70s. I was a doctor at Goddard College from 72 to 74. Also worked with Dr. Stu Copans doing medical assessments at various communes, mostly in northern Vermont. And also was part of the collective that wrote the Home Health Handbook, which I don't know if your folks know
about
that.
We have copies of it.
And I wrote the pediatric section of that. I'm a pediatrician. And also lived communally in Adamant when I was the doctor at Goddard with other people. The folks at Goddard had a very radical faculty at that time.
Yep.
John Freund's was one of the Chicago Seven, was on the faculty teaching chemistry.
Well, Jack, let me ask Jackie this question. The health of – because these communes were in very rural areas. They usually had no electricity, no phone. What was the health care like? Were they getting the proper health care?
In some instances, no. And this was a big concern of the medical community, UVM in particular, like your caller's talking about. But also the other communes recognized this. And so they got together. I mean, this was an alliance that was put together between interns at UVM, doctors at UVM, members of the communes. They traveled around and they put together this home health handbook. We talked and interviewed Stuart Copans. We talked to another doctor who helped set up a health clinic down in Howard Freed down in Brattleboro with Barry White, Danny Stein, who actually was a Weather Underground person who finally got arrested. But health was a big concern, and those alliances were really important. The Home Health Handbook went through three different issues. Also, the local churches, BEAM, the Ecumenical Council in Burlington, helped fund that book to go out. So these alliances were really important, and people were very well the health issues coming up in the communes.
And Kate Delos, I want to peer one more time into these communes. How were the women treated? Was the feminist movement, you know, one of the big things they were rallying around?
Eventually it was. You know, again, I should have known this really from comparing the dates, but the feminist movement, when it really started to pick up speed in the early 1970s, of course, came in after the start of many of these communes. And so, for example, at the commune that my book is mostly about, Myrtle Hill, the experience of feminism and feminist consciousness came into their communal experience. Other communes that were more politically radical, that were on the forefront of thinking, progressive, radical thinking nationwide, they had had feminist consciousness more close to their founding, and some of them had instituted from the beginning work policies to be sure that there was gender parity between work. But places like Myrtle Hill that weren't particularly political and weren't particularly thinking like that kind of found themselves, without meaning to, reproducing gender work patterns that of their parents' kind of, conventional middle-class homes that they didn't intend to, where the women were doing all of the cooking and cleaning, the men were doing all of the outdoor work. That happened at this one particular commune, but you see it echoed in writing about communes nationwide. There's a great article in the Holler's catalog from this time called Women in Communes, in which the women describe an experiment that they did to sort of decide they don't want to just automatically have to do the dishes at the end of the day. So they finished their work, and then the women, just as an experiment, went out to the fields, and the men were furious and refused to cook them dinner and wouldn't clean up. They sort of report this back, and it's not the only report like that. And so I think in a lot of ways I heard people from communes at this time period, the feminist movement, and as it was nationwide, required adjustments. I mean, it required communities, like all families, to figure out how to make that work better for them. And some communities could handle that and could adjust, and some communities really just had a really hard time. It was very, very difficult on the group.
And Amanda Gustin, we only have about a minute left. Tell us what people will find when your exhibit opens at the Vermont Historical Society.
Yeah, so if you come to Barrie, to the Vermont History Center, to see the exhibit, we have a number of objects that have been loaned or donated to the Vermont Historical Society as part of this project. Photographs, posters. We're going to ring the entire room with posters from the 1970s. And the centerpiece of the exhibit under construction at this moment is a geodesic dome that will hopefully lend a nice air, retro air to the space. And I should also tell you that the walls are painted citrus blast orange. So we're hoping to really recreate that atmosphere, but also share the sense of history.
Well, that geodesic dome makes me and Buckminster Fuller happy. Kate Dalos is author of the new book, We Are As Gods, Back to the Land in the 1970s, on the quest for a new America, that relates the stories of some communes in Vermont. Jackie Calder and Amanda Gustin are with the Vermont Historical Society. The Society has been working for a couple of years on the project called Freaks, Radicals, and Hippies, Counterculture in 1970s Vermont. That exhibit that Amanda talked about will open on Saturday, September 24th at their Barrie headquarters. And we have a link for information at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. I want to thank all three of you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so
You're
much
welcome.
For having me.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Vermont Edition, we turn our attention back to politics. Our guest is Congressman Peter Welch, and he'll take your questions on issues that you want Congress to address. You can email vermontedition@vpr.net and listen live tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Sam Gale Rosen and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels, and our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Rick Singeri. Thanks for listening. Peace out.